This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
We meet today at a crossroads of history. Our world is in upheaval. In the Middle East, Iran's axis of terror confronts America, Israel, and our Arab friends. This is not a clash of civilizations. It's a clash between barbarism and civilization. It's a clash between those who glorify death and those who sanctify life.
That was Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu speaking out boldly before the U.S. Congress. He arrived in the United States this week at a time of great political upheaval. And that was a powerful reminder to the United States. While you're busy tearing yourselves apart at home, there's a dangerous world out there. We'll look at the roller coaster that is U.S. politics, Mr. Netanyahu's speech, a critical Middle Eastern peace deal, and much more on today's Trumpet Hour. So before we dig into Mr. Netanyahu's speech, I think we need a bit of an update on who exactly is running the show in the United States. This time last week, we were trying to speculate, is Joe Biden going to last? Is he going to be out? Now we have the answer. So to get us up to speed, we'll first get an update from our U.S. correspondent, Andrew Miller.
Yeah, well, that is a very good question in a lot of people's mind. Who is running the United States? And we now have a definitive answer that it's not Joe Biden. Like I said, last week we were speculating that the pressure on him to resign was building. Finally, just last Sunday, he announced in a very strange way. He was still in his home in Delaware, reportedly getting over COVID. That just posted a letter on his X account, on his X social media account, saying that he was resigning from the race. And we didn't see or hear anything from Biden for a number of days after that letter until later in the week, he actually did get up, address the nation, and said that he needs to put American democracy above his personal ambition. And so is dropping out of the race. Surprisingly, I think the last time something similar to this happened, or at least when Richard Nixon resigned from the presidency, the stock market went crazy. I mean, and I guess this is a lesser resignation. He hasn't resigned as president, at least not yet. He's just dropped out of the race. Financial markets seem pretty calm, which means that most Americans in the know have realized that the same Biden handlers who were making the decisions before he dropped out are still making the decisions now. And it is just something that, like I said, this is really a Democratic attempt. It's been endorsed by Barack Obama, endorsed by Bill and Hillary Clinton, and endorsed by dozens of top Democrats in Congress to just try to give them their best chance at beating Donald Trump in this election. I do find it ironic, though, on Wednesday, the Democratic National Convention changed its own rules to allow Vice President Harris to be nominated as their official nominee before the convention. Apparently, the state of Ohio had some deadline on August 7th, so now they're actually wanting to have the delegates nominate Harris as their new nominee on their convention, instead of just having an open convention where you can debate the different possibilities. So putting that together with Biden's speech is apparently the Democratic Party thinks that saving American democracy from Donald Trump is so important that they don't actually have time to let hold a new primary or let any of the Democratic voters weigh in or vote or do anything Democratic about who their nominee is. Biden's delegates have just, a lot of them had received money, campaign donations to the Biden-Harris ticket. So they're like, well, the money was given to Biden-Harris. So as long as it's either Biden or Harris, we still get to keep the campaign donations. So we're keeping the campaign donations, nominating Harris on the 7th. she'll pick a vice president before then. And we're running with this into the new election. The American people can vote on whether they want Biden or Trump then, but we're not actually giving the American people any vote on whether they'd prefer any of the other 300 million people in America to be the Democratic Party nominee.
Yes, I think that really is remarkable to see this kind of stitch up now happening in the United States. If you think about the vision behind the founding of the United States and the founding fathers to be a shining city on the hill, a beacon of good governance and democracy, and what we're seeing this week is something you'd expect to see in the Soviet Union, with all of these things being manipulated behind the scenes. It's all kind of backroom deals. It's, you know, Churchill, as Churchill would say about the Kremlin, you kind of, there's a lot of fighting and then you know who's won when the bones come out from under the carpet. That's kind of the impression that you get from America. Like this last week, we've been trying to read the tea leaves and work out who's up, who's down. Is Obama behind Kamala? Is him not behind Kamala? And we got this kind of awkward video that they put out just today that President Obama is formally endorsing Kamala Harris.
Kamala!
Hi!
Hey there!
Oh, hi, you're both together. Oh, it's good to hear you both.
I can't have this phone call without saying to my girl Kamala, I am proud of you. This is going to be historic.
We called to say Michelle and I couldn't be prouder to endorse you and to do everything we can to get you through this election and into the Oval Office.
Oh my goodness. Michelle, Barack, this means so much to me. I am looking forward to doing this with the two of you, Doug and I both, and getting out there, being on the road. But most of all, I just want to tell you the words you have spoken and the friendship that you have given over all these years mean more than I can express. So thank you both. It means so much. And we're going to have some fun with this too, aren't we?
I genuinely don't know whether Barack Obama really wants Kamala Harris to be president or not, or what's maneuvering behind the scenes. But I think that's kind of the point. Like, we're moving away from clear and open, transparent democracy and law to the point where it is backroom deals determine, if not who's going to be president. Certainly, I think Barack Obama would like it to be backroom deals determine who's going to be president, but at least who's going to be then the leading contender.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, and there's a lot of gossip and political rumors going around Washington, D.C. right now as to whether Barack Obama wanted Harris as the nominee from the beginning, or whether he's angry at Joe Biden for endorsing Harris so that now she has so much support that he kind of had to just rubber stamp it on the end, even though he would have preferred someone different. I'm keeping a close eye on it and still not exactly sure if everything's going according to Barack Obama's plan or not in this situation. However, that is exactly the point, is that all the news coverage about this has been like, well, what does Obama think? There's news stories about how Biden's angry with Obama because he worked behind his back to force him out of office. There's speculation as to whether Obama was propping up Harris as a successor, or maybe whether he didn't want Harris as a successor and is losing control of the party. But in all of this, the discussion you don't see happening is, why doesn't the Democratic National Convention, Biden's clearly senile and needs to resign, but why doesn't the DNC hold an open convention? The delegates debate the best choice and even send out a referendum to Democratic Party voters saying that, hey, we held a primary at the beginning part of this year to get the voters' opinion on who do you want to be the candidate in this American democracy. And now, instead of sending out a referendum or doing a mini primary or doing all these other options that were discussed, they've pretty much settled on, like, who is Obama going to endorse? And then I guess the American people, they'll still get to vote, they're kindly enough, for which of these two candidates, but it's which of these two candidates are selected for us. But like, they had no say in who the Democratic Party nominee was going to be, which really does, I think it really does justify things we've been saying on this program, things that our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Flory, has written in America Under Attack and other books, that this has really been the third term of Barack Obama, and he's been the puppet master for years. I think Newsweek even used the term puppet master describing Obama and how he forced Biden out of office last week. So this is something that, like, back in 2021, when you were saying that Obama was the puppet master behind Biden, there were a number of conservatives pointing that out. Mr. Stephen Flores had a number of those conservatives on his radio program, The Trumpet Daily. But it wasn't a majority opinion in the Republican Party. And now you're even getting even liberal news magazines, Newsweek and the like, saying that it's pretty clear that Obama's been the puppet master behind Biden this whole time. He's the one who forced Biden out of office. The stock market's not going crazy because all the investors know that the guy who was running America before, Barack Obama, is still running America. And whether or not he preferred Kamala, the fact that people are talking about this is significant. And now the fact that he's done that awkward phone call you just played is significant. So the verse I brought with me today is, I think, the same verse I brought with me last week in Amos 7, verse 8, where God's talking to a prophet. Amos says he's going to set a plumb line in the midst of his people Israel and measure them, and then he's not going to pass by them anymore. Now, the phrase that he's not going to pass by them anymore infers that he has passed by them already. And actually, if you read the rest of that chapter, he's passed by them two other times before that. We're also putting together the next edition of the Trumpet print edition this week. Our editor-in-chief has a big article in there about God passing by America and then him not passing by again. So God is going to save America from this really Soviet-style apartheid backroom dealing, trying to install candidates without giving the voters a say, so that the people have a chance to repent. Because in a North Korean-style dictatorship, or even a less severe dictatorship, it's hard for people to repent when the penalty for repenting is going to a gulag. God wants to make sure the American people have enough freedom that it's their choice whether they repent and turn back to him or not. It does really show, as we'll bring out in this next issue of the Trumpet, like why God has to intervene in American politics to make sure that our constitutional structure of government and even American democracy is preserved for a while longer. Because if this, the way things are going in the Democratic Party now, where you can just get these backroom deals where Barack Obama and a cabal of technocrats start installing the head of the biggest political party in America and the head of the nation of America, if they could, that doesn't give a lot of people a lot of freedom to decide what they want to do with their life.
Now, while all this was going on, we had Netanyahu's visit, this story that we opened with. And here I'd like to bring in Mihailo Zekic into this discussion as well. And there's a lot about this speech that's important from the perspective of the United States and of the Middle East. But he obviously, you know, you've got kind of all of this maneuvering, all of this chaos going around within America. And then Netanyahu arrives. And you have he arrives. I don't think there was anyone there at the airport to greet him, not even the Secretary of State. There's a lot of protests going on. Perhaps, Andrew, first off, you'd like to talk a bit about just how he was received as he made this pretty important visit, you know, a wartime leader of one of America's closest allies to the United States.
Yeah, it really was just scandalous how that happened, because, like, politics aside, whether Joe Biden personally likes Netanyahu or not, he did invite him to this country to meet with him and to address Congress. And it is just common diplomatic courtesy. And in that case, for a head of state, the prime minister of Israel, the normal protocol is for the president himself to go receive him at the airport, Joe Biden himself. Now, he was resigning and they say he had COVID, so maybe there were extenuating circumstances where that couldn't happen. But in that case, the next is like send, like you said, either the vice president or the secretary of state to meet him at the airport. I think we've covered on this program before too, like about some of the diplomatic slights, like Barack Obama sending the Churchill bus back to England and how that was a slight against England. This is a diplomatic slight against Israel, like an order of magnitude bigger than that. And then also, they also just had the war protest. I even saw a bunch of these pro-Hamas protesters like at the Capitol building, which after they made as big a deal as they did about the January 6th protesters needing to be charged under the Sabine-Oxley Act and going to prison for 20 years for trespassing on Capitol grounds, the fact that they let those pro-Hamas protesters anywhere near the Capitol right after a U.S. presidential candidate was almost shot shows a stunning disregard for Benjamin Netanyahu's life, for one, and is also just another one of those just big diplomatic, I was going to say faux pas, but it's worse than faux pas. Like they told him to come here and then just really disrespected him in every way an administration can disrespect a world leader.
Well, Kamala Harris didn't even come to the speech. I thought this was from an article Melanie Phillips wrote about the trip, and I thought it makes a really good point. She said, the more urgent realization now must be the danger posed by the liberal mindset that characterizes the Democratic Party in America and the cultural elites that rule the left. I mean, you look at the protests that were going on. I think that we've all seen the picture of, was it Rashida Tlaib or one of the members of the squad who's kind of holding up this sign that says war criminal, which she was roundly and rightly mocked for. It does expose now that it used to be that an Israeli leader could come and visit Israel and it would not be a partisan thing, that it would not be that you'd have a united house. Whereas this time you had about 70 Democrats staying away. We had one Republican staying away. It's become a very partisan issue. And it shows, you know, that there is Israel's best friend no longer has its back the way that it used to. And I think that is a big takeaway from that trip. But then we had his speech, and I think there was quite a powerful warning coming from his speech. And okay, he didn't necessarily warn about the danger posed by the liberal mindset, but here's a clip that gives you an idea of the real laser focus he had on Iran.
My friends, in the Middle East, Iran is virtually behind all the terrorism, all the turmoil, all the chaos, all the killing. And that should come as no surprise. When he founded the Islamic Republic, Ayatollah Khomeini pledged, we will export our revolution to the entire world. We will export the Islamic revolution to the entire world. Now ask yourself, which country ultimately stands in the way of Iran's maniacal plans to impose radical Islam on the world? And the answer is clear. It's America, the guardian of Western civilization and the world's greatest power. That's why Iran sees America as its greatest enemy.
So, Simon, a powerful warning about the dangers of Iran then from Mr. Netanyahu's speech.
Yes, and what I think was probably, at least for me, most eye-opening was just the reception he got from that. You mentioned that quite a few people stayed away. It was actually a little bit strange because he was supposed to be speaking to the joint houses of Congress, the House of Representatives and the Senate, and Kamala Harris, as the vice president, is supposed to preside over the Senate. And not only did she not show up, but also President pro tempore of the Senate, Patty Murray. So in the traditional seat where somebody would be sitting as ceremonially over the Senate, they put in Senator Ben Cardin there as a replacement. But I think all those people that didn't show up, there were quite a few other prominent people that didn't, they actually played in Netanyahu's hand quite a bit, because of the people that were there, you could just feel, I just watched the speech from the internet, even from the internet, you could just feel the electricity in the room, the energy. There was like 51 ovations in a 55-minute speech. And most of them apparently weren't, a lot of them weren't even parts of the speech, and you could see Netanyahu was saving for applause. People just got up and started cheering him on. We could play just a little clip, just of a sample of that.
My friends, if you remember one thing from the speech, remember this. Our enemies are your enemies. Our fight is your fight, and our victory will be your victory.
Yeah, they're just a little bit extended applause, but the whole point of that is that wasn't uncommon in the speech. There was a lot of that, including when he entered the room. It took a few minutes just to get everybody to seemingly calm down. And I think that shows the energy of at least what many on the Republican side are thinking and what many people that oppose everything that's going on in the government, everything that's going on with these Soviet shenanigans like you were talking about. And see, there was a little bit of, I guess you could say, marketing towards the audience. He talked a little bit about how Israel's fighting this war so America doesn't have to put boots on the ground. You could sort of tell he was trying to package things for more the isolationist crowd. But overall, especially considering how you hear a lot of people on the Republican side talking about America needs to stop involving itself as much in the world, America needs to conserve, that was something that Netanyahu had as an uphill battle in this speech. And I think he handled it really, really well. And we talked on this program before about changes coming up into the United States. Andrew mentioned how God is going to give a bit of a saving of what's going on in the country. And we've talked on this program before how Israel, the state of Israel, is going to be on or part of this as well. This whatever's going to happen in America is going to come to help Israel, the state of Israel, the Jewish state as well. And I also noticed you mentioned like Iran specifically. I don't hear anybody in the media talking so much about this being Iran's war as Netanyahu does. I mean, you hear a lot about people, okay, things going on in Gaza, we have to do something with Hezbollah, whatever. A lot of people see these as separate groups. Netanyahu put the finger as, no, whatever we're doing with Gaza, with Hezbollah, with the Houthis, that all ties back to Iran. He has a singular focus that in order to conduct this war, you don't really see anywhere else. And I think this speech was a very good demonstration of that.
That's a good point on that he really sees the root cause of this. I like this quote. This is from our Ezekiel, the End Time Prophet booklet, where Mr. Flurry talks about a prophecy or a prophecy that describes in Ezekiel 33, that describes people setting up their own watchman, picking a watchman, having somebody warn. And he writes, the only other modern leader outside of God's church who has delivered a watchman warning similar to Sir Winston Churchill would be Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He talks about the last speech that Netanyahu gave, or a previous speech that he gave to the U.S. House of Congress, where he says, when U.S. President Barack Obama started negotiating a nuclear deal with Iran, the world's leading sponsor of terrorism, only Mr. Netanyahu came to speak before the U.S. Congress, warning them of the catastrophic consequences of such a nuclear deal. And it's an important, you know, to see the importance of that warning. You know, our latest Trumpet print edition has the war on Netanyahu right there as the front cover. And that talks about really the spiritual dimension of the war on Netanyahu, that there really is a strong force trying to shut him down. And a big part of that is because he is sounding a physical watchman warning, not a call to repentance. But as Mr. Flurry wrote about in that Ezekiel, the End Time Prophet booklet, there is a kind of watchman warning coming out from these messages. And it, you know, would America be so squabbling, so divided, if they realized how dangerous the world is out there, that there is a country, Iran, developing nuclear weapons? And I know you passed something on to me this morning, Simon, a news story showing that Iran is working with an unspecified Latin American governments to bring nuclear material right into America's backyard. America's got an open border. Iran is bringing nuclear material into Latin America. And you could have something very scary, very easily make its way into the United States. And so Netanyahu is up there realizing, okay, while you're having all of your squabbles about leadership and these things, this is the evil world that we live in. And so it was an important speech, I think, because of that. And it really gets to why there's a war against Netanyahu, like our previous cover said. But you've also highlighted, Simon, in some of our discussions, and I think you're working on an article for the Trumpet website, as powerful as a warning as Mr. Netanyahu gave, there was also an important blind spot in his speech.
Yes, I can't remember exactly where, but our editor-in-chief, Mr. Fleury, once said, no, sorry, it was Herbert W. Armstrong, the editor-in-chief of our predecessor magazine. At the end of World War II, he said that America has a problem of only seeing one enemy at a time. And in World War II, it was Germany. Germany was warring against the Soviet Union, so the natural thing to do was to help build up the Soviet Union, help them defeat Germany. After the war, the Soviets were the new enemy, so now America's job was to build Germany up to counter the Soviets. I don't think Israel has quite that big of a problem as, say, America's demonstrated, at least back then. But you do see it in certain parts of his speech. For one hand, I think that this is a bit notable even without our commentary on this, because the next few clips I'm going to play to you, this is some statements that Netanyahu's made before, but this is by far the most official setting he's done it in, which basically confirms its government policy.
Gaza should have a civilian administration run by Palestinians who do not seek to destroy Israel. That's not too much to ask. It's a fundamental thing that we have a right to demand that you receive. A new generation of Palestinians must no longer be taught to hate Jews, but rather to live in peace with us. Those twin words, demilitarization and de-radicalization, those two concepts were applied to Germany and Japan after World War II, and that led to decades of peace, prosperity, and security. Following our victory, with the help of regional partners, the demilitarization and de-radicalization of Gaza can also lead to a future of security, prosperity, and peace. That's my vision for Gaza.
Tying into World War II there, both Mr. Armstrong and Mr. Fleury had spoken quite a bit about how denazification of Germany did not accomplish what it was supposed to do, that it was abandoned way too early, and that there still are problems in Germany to this day regarding far-right sympathies and that far-right spirit rising up under the underground. We have a lot of material on our website about that. But that aside, Netanyahu used that as a positive example. It wasn't a positive example, and it's going to take a lot to turn Gaza into something remotely positive as well. I mean, you look at some of the material that Hamas's educational system feeds their young people, training them up to be terrorists, training them up to get excited to go on stabbing sprees or to be martyrs for the homeland. I mean, that's something that I don't even think Germany and Japan had as thorough of a time indoctrinating their young people as Hamas has been able to manage. But the thing that I want to focus in on a little bit more was he talked about regional partners. And when he says that, he means by the Arab states that have friendlier relations with Israel or even relations at all. Right now, 2024, it's not 1973, it's not 1967. The whole of the Muslim world from North Africa to the Indian subcontinent is not raging mad. We need to extinguish Israel. There are countries that Israel has made alliances with. Israel has opened up relations with, most notably in the Abraham Accords, the Gulf States, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain. Egypt has been a longstanding partner of Israel's. And the implication is that Netanyahu is hoping some of these countries can come together and help rebuild Gaza. And for at least the United Arab Emirates, they've already said they want to start an international coalition to do that. Now, part of the reason for that is that the longer Israel stays in Gaza, the more bad press they get in the international media, the larger of chances that sanctions or even international criminal warrants get up against them. But if it's Arab countries doing it, then it's a little bit less controversial. But it's not just restructuring Gaza that Netanyahu is hoping some of these Arab countries will get involved with. He also said something else in a clip we'll play now.
The new alliance I envision would be a natural extension of the groundbreaking Abraham Accords. Those accords saw peace forged between Israel and four Arab countries, and they were supported by Republicans and Democrats alike. I have a name for this new alliance. I think we should call it the Abraham Alliance.
Now, basically, we cut the clip of there for time's sake, but what he was talking about was basically a Middle Eastern NATO. And opening up to any country willing to make peace in Israel, with Israel, that includes a lot of countries today in the Middle East. It includes, I mentioned the Emirates, Morocco, Saudi Arabia is the big prize. Most of these countries weren't, say, the tip of the spear trying to go after Israel per se, but regardless of whatever their governments stand for, huge portions of their own people don't actually like what's going on. They don't necessarily like Israel. They don't necessarily want to have peace with Israel. There's still a very thick anti-Semitic sentiment among a lot of these populations. And for Israel to trust countries that, in some cases, like the Saudis, were at war with Israel within living memory, I mean, it's a lot. It's Israel putting a lot of trust in these countries in the long term, and it's something that, as unstable as the politics in the Middle East can be, is not particularly wise.
And it's something that really caused us to sit up and take notice, because this is, you know, we've been looking specifically for Israel to, and we've been warning specifically about Israel trusting in these other countries, and that they're going to trust in countries that are fundamentally not trustworthy, and that is a real problem. But also we've specifically said which countries it's going to be, and this is all in Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Plury's book, The King of the South, where he goes through in detail which countries are going to be the one that Israel mistakenly trusts in. And it's the same ones, exactly the same ones that Benjamin Netanyahu talks about. It's just such a powerful, fulfilled Bible prophecy. I mean, this is, again, a prediction Mr. Flurry made, or a prophecy or a prediction based on Bible prophecy just a decade or two ago, and you can watch it happen in real time.
Yes, that prophecy specifically is in Psalm 83, the first eight verses. It talks about a coalition that comes together to that the name of Israel may be no more in remembrance. These two peoples have never come together, either in biblical history or in secular history. That's how we know it's a prophecy, and I won't read the whole passage, but it talks about countries like Edom, the Ishmaelites, Moab, the Hagarenes, Gebal, the Philistines, Tyre. These groups of people, as Mr. Flurry writes in The King of the South, their modern descendants include countries like Turkey, that's the Edomites, the Ishmaelites are Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states, even they in Muslim heritage and tradition, they know that. Ammon and Moab, those are the two peoples that inhabited Jordan. And there is a little bit of nuance to this prophecy, this certain countries that aren't in that camp yet that we expect to be. But again, those are the countries that Mr. Netanyahu was talking about. Those are the countries he mentioned, the April barrage of drones that Iran sent, and how countries like Jordan, like Saudi Arabia, took to defend Israel, and that we need to build off of that. That's what he's talking about. If you want to tie it in with another prophecy in Daniel 11, verse 41, it's a prophecy we go to on this program quite a bit. I won't take the time to talk too much about this, but it talks about a king of the north coming in and invading Israel. That king of the north is a German-led Europe. Asher, also mentioned in Psalm 83, that's the link between the two prophecies. But it specifically says that he will enter into the glorious land. That word enter, editor-in-chief has talked about, means a peaceful entry, as in Israel invites them in as peacekeepers. It trusts them. It sees them as somebody that can protect them. And by extension, it trusts this alliance that they have built as well. So, again, there's a lot more that has to happen before this alliance is fully formed. But this alliance, that's exactly what Netanyahu is calling for. And if he's willing to say this publicly like this without, say, embarrassing countries to stay away, that his foreign minister once talked about doing a peace deal with Libya, and just the news of that breaking out caused the Libyans to back away because they didn't want to be associated with the Zionist enemy, so to speak. But if he's willing to say this so publicly, that tells me that the people in Riyadh, the people in Amman, the people in Abu Dhabi, they're thinking this as well. And it's only going to be a matter of time before they put these thoughts, before they put these words into actual action, tangible on the ground.
So that, of course, was an important story from the Middle East. But can you give us your rundown of some of these other secondary stories that are also very important?
Well, as usual, a lot to get to. Tying in with Netanyahu's visit to Washington is that Joe Biden finally invited him to the White House. You can remember that for years, that was a big carrot and stick that he was tangling Netanyahu, a big snub for not inviting him over. And the news with everything else, this was sort of looked under the radar of a lot of people. What changed with Joe Biden's mentality? Whether it has anything to do with the electoral rift that Andrew talked about, we don't know, but still something noteworthy. On July 22nd, you mentioned Iran going into Latin America. This was actually a video put up on the official website of Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. He actually does have a website. He has a Twitter account, even, funnily enough. But it was an interview with the head of his atomic energy organization, Mohammad Eslami. And he talked about exporting services of nuclear material to certain countries, specifying that one of them was in Latin America, and that there were quite a few other countries that were waiting to take part in these services. One expert he specified was heavy water, which of course is used to enrich uranium to make a nuclear weapon. I suspect the country he was referring to was Venezuela, simply because Iran has already done so much with that country, including stationing their own warships, even sending Hezbollah to train in there in South America. And remember that next time you see stories of Venezuelan refugees coming to the southern border. That same day, U.S. Senator Ted Cruz submitted a letter to the White House accusing the executive government of allowing American mechanical parts to find its way to Iran to help develop weapons, including drones, through lack of sanction enforcement. I'll just read a quote here. Quote, "The construction of the drones is enabled by the regime's access to American components, and indeed the drones are built almost entirely from components produced by U.S. companies, including ones cannibalized from other machines or transferred through third or fourth party distributors using convoluted routes to move tiny electronics," end quote. So the next time you hear stories about whether it's Iran sending a barrage of drones to Israel, or they use drones to attack that American base in Jordan, and they're selling drones to Russia to use in Ukraine, according to Ted Cruz and his sources, those are made with American parts. It's American, at least through lack of sanctions enforcement, the American government letting these weapons get developed for these wars, which is, I mean, unsettling to say the least.
And there's one more important story we did want to hit with the Middle East, where has China brought peace to two bitterly divided factions? No, not Israel and the Palestinians, but Fatah and Hamas, where these two different terrorist groups have had this divide, and that's been absolutely critical for Israel. It means that their enemies are divided. This has made it easier for Israel to resist calls to set up a Palestinian state, because you know every time you give the Palestinians more territory, they use it to attack Israel. And this division has made it easier for Israel to resist those pressures. But we're looking like that divide that's been going on, I think, since the 2000, you know, maybe looking at 20 years now, could be at an end. So to tell us more about that, we'll hear once again from Mihailo.
Yes, so on Tuesday, Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi announced that 14 Palestinian factions in Beijing agreed to what they call the Beijing Declaration, to basically come together in a type of unity government, mainly to govern Gaza after the war, but also includes a joint government of the West Bank and what they call Al-Quds, or Jerusalem. They didn't specify specifically which 14 factions were involved, but with the photos that they released, you could see prominent individuals from both Fatah and Hamas. Palestinian Islamic Jihad, probably the third biggest, most dangerous group in the Palestinian territories, confirmed they took part as well. And we don't know the exact details. I haven't publicly released on what exactly will happen, but they did specify that it's going to happen with the blessing of the Palestinian Authority, or the quasi-government that rules over part of the West Bank, and that everybody wants to rule over Gaza, but Israel and some of these other Arab countries aren't too thrilled about that. You would think this would set off a lot of alarm bells. I mean, never mind Hamas. Regardless, whichever these groups are, most likely all of them have a lot of blood on their hands, of Israelis, of Palestinians, and of other people potentially. Yet, a lot of people in the international community are saying this is a good thing. Stephane Dujarric, who's the spokesman for UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, he was asked by media what the Secretary General was thinking about this, and they said they supported the move, and that Palestinian unity in this way is going to help bring about a two-state solution. Now, if you imagine Jalisco and MS-13 and maybe some of these other cartels coming together to form a unity government, if somebody in the UN said this was a good deal for Mexico, he'd probably lose his job. But because it's the Palestinians, because it's Israel, people take a pass at that. This is quoting also the Global Times from what the EU's special representative to the Middle Eastern peace process told the Chinese government, quote, "It is a remarkable achievement and fully demonstrates China's positive and constructive role in the Middle East peace process, noting that the EU looks forward to further strengthening communication with China, jointly pushing for a ceasefire and the settlement of the Palestinian question on the basis of the two-state solution," end quote. A lot of diplomatic ease there, but even the EU is on the side of the Chinese and what they're doing here, basically turning the West Bank, the Palestinian Authority, into this giant terror super entity. And again, who knows what's going to happen on the ground? The last time this tried to happen was in 2017. It fell apart right after that. This could very well happen as well. But if it doesn't, bringing Hamas into the West Bank would be a whole game changer in this war for Israel. I mean, never mind the fact that it directly borders Jerusalem, its capital, Israel's capital, but there's also thousands of Israeli settlers living in and among these pockets where Hamas could all of a sudden launch a terror attack way bigger than October 7th. And the reason we're watching this specifically is because of a prophecy in Zechariah 14 verses 1 to 2, which speaks of the day of the Lord and all this chaos hitting Israel and the Holy Land. But verse 2 specifies that half of the city or half of Jerusalem will go forth into captivity. What exactly does that all mean? Well, our editor-in-chief, this is what he wrote in his booklet, Jerusalem Prophecy, quote, "Today the Arabs live in roughly one half of Jerusalem. They just don't control it. Yet. When such an attack occurs, the Jews couldn't effectively drop bombs, especially nuclear bombs, on one half of their own city." Further down, he says, "The present violence is an embryo that is about to explode into much greater violence. That is the critical event prophesied in Zechariah 14, verse 2. If you look at the context a little bit, he elaborates more in the booklet. Basically, the Palestinians getting organized and taking half of Jerusalem is the catalyst for World War III, is the catalyst for all these other prophecies we're talking about. The Palestinians aren't nearly organized enough to deal with that right now. But if Hamas gets into the West Bank, if they all unite, they very well could be.
And really, this all revolves around Jerusalem. This peace deal brings these Palestinians, brings basically Iranian-backed terrorists a step closer to taking half of Jerusalem. What we were talking about before, about Benjamin Netanyahu trusting in these peace deals from Hamas and or trusting in the countries around Israel to take care of Hamas in Gaza. That all gets back to them wanting Jerusalem, these other Arab countries wanting to Jerusalem. It's going to invite in a European power to come and keep the peace that wants Jerusalem. Jerusalem really is the focal point of all of end time prophecy. And we have just a fantastic book, The Eternal Has Chosen Jerusalem, that explains why, that explains so much of this bad news that is coming to Jerusalem, but also puts it in the picture of the city that God has chosen and all of the wonderful good news that's going to come to the whole world from Jerusalem. So thank you very much for covering all of that with us, Mihailo. We've been talking about these groups that are off in China. We'll bring now Jeremiah Jacques into the story. Obviously, this greatly increases the prestige of China on the international scene. But Jeremiah covers Asia for us. Do you want to give us a rundown of some of the other important news coming out of Asia?
Sure, yes. Well, on Thursday, Russia and China conducted joint air patrols around the Bering Sea. This was with their strategic bombers, and they actually entered Alaska's Air Defense Identification Zone, which is American airspace, and that was a first. The first time Russia and China have violated this airspace at the same time. And American and Canadian fighter jets did intercept them, but this is just one more indication of how brazen and how provocative Russia and China are becoming, and another indication of how close these two are drawing to each other. Another quick Russia story here. This is about a grim milestone that was just crossed this week. And it is that since the beginning of the full-scale war on Ukraine, the Russian army has destroyed 99 hospitals in Ukraine. Well over 1,000 hospitals have been damaged to varying degrees, but these 99 have been destroyed by the Russians beyond repair. So it's more evidence of just what a wicked war this is. The Russians strike civilians and civilian targets without a moment's hesitation. And the damage that they're doing as the months go on and on is catastrophic. Another quick story here about Japan and the American soldiers that are stationed there. America's military presence in Japan dates back to the end of World War II, and we have more than 50,000 U.S. troops there. But this has been kind of a perennial source of tension between the two countries, with the Japanese often, you know, speaking out against noise and pollution caused by the U.S. troops. And most significantly, the Japanese have been utterly outraged by crime committed by the Americans, even including violent crimes, especially against Japanese women. And this week, a story broke that Japanese police had been covering up a number of sexual assault cases involving U.S. military personnel. There were five cases that had not been disclosed just because the Japanese authorities apparently feared that the Japanese public would be upset. But those cases are now disclosed. And one of the victims was even a minor. So just very disturbing crimes here. And at the Trumpet, we expect the U.S.-Japan alliance to be broken soon. So developments like this can help us to see just how much tension there is in that alliance. And they showed that the Japanese have some very good reasons to want the Americans out of their country.
Now, your main story, I believe, brings us back to China and a very real possibility that they're preparing for war.
That's right. Yes, the main story is that the Chinese Communist Party is stockpiling massive amounts of certain commodities, and that's because they are preparing for war. The Economist compiled some of the numbers about this in a July 23rd article, and the numbers are, they're really arresting. China's stockpile of crude oil is now about 1.3 billion barrels. That's enough to cover the country's import needs for about 115 days. And their storage capacity for crude is now around 2 billion barrels. And then for liquefied gas, they've got about 25 billion cubic meters in storage now, enough to meet their needs for quite a while. And it's not just energy. China is also stockpiling food. They've got about 50% of the world's total wheat stocks, according to this report, in storage. 50% for a country that's only 17% of the global population. And then for maize and rice, it's even more of the total. China has about 70% of total maize stocks and also 70% of total rice stocks. And then for soybeans, the Chinese have almost 40 million tons now, which is double what they had just a few years ago. So this is, it's just a stunning amount of energy and food that China is amassing and storing. And The Economist writes, "These vast new holdings of grain, natural gas, and oil suggest trouble ahead. The supplies China is after are exactly those it would need to survive a protracted conflict." So China, you know, we know that China is deeply dependent on imports for its energy and for its food. Unlike America and Russia, China doesn't produce very much energy. They don't have nearly enough energy in the ground there to be self-sufficient, not even close. And with food, they're even more dependent on buying from other countries. China is the world's largest importer of food, the world's hungriest country. And the leaders of the Chinese Communist Party, they're of course well aware of all of this. And they understand that if they were to find themselves at war, perhaps after invading Taiwan or something along those lines, then their enemies could blockade the supply lines that they depend on so much. And the Chinese know that even a robust sanctions regime could really threaten a lot of their grain imports and natural gas and oil imports that they depend on so much. So just as The Economist wrote there, they seem to be stockpiling all of this in advance of a conflict, just to kind of insulate themselves from the fallout that might result from that. We speak quite often about China's military buildup, you know, all of the nuclear weapons and the advanced missiles and warships that China's building and accruing. And with this stockpile of energy and food, we see sort of the other half of that same equation. And it all comes together to show that China is tirelessly preparing for war. And Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury has really called a lot of attention over the years to China's military buildup in all the different ways that China's pushing toward war and preparing for war. He has especially emphasized the way China's dead set on using all of its growing military power to assert control over the South China Sea. And he has shown just how worrying such a takeover would be for global peace and global trade. He wrote an article in the Trumpet's July 2016 print edition all about that. It's called China is Steering the World Toward War. And he shows in that article how his understanding of all of that is founded on Bible prophecy, especially passages in Deuteronomy and Ezekiel and Isaiah. So if anyone would like to better understand the big picture of China's militarization and its stockpiling of all these goods to help it prepare for war and what it means for America and for the whole world, I would encourage them to check out that article, China is Steering the World Toward War.
Great. Thank you for that, Jeremiah. Well, we spent quite a lot of time on the Middle East. We haven't reserved a huge amount of time to cover Europe, but there is one more story I want to kind of squeeze in here, focusing on Europe just at the end. This is late July, getting into August. All the world leaders tend to go on holiday. And this story kind of relates to that because it is the Olympic Games. They open tonight. You've got what is planned to be, I think, one of the most extravagant openings in France. And I think that this has a potential to shine a really interesting spotlight on France. Already the debt today has been pretty dramatic. There have been sabotage attempts or successful sabotage on railway links across France that have caused some real problems for the games. The head of France's high-speed rail network, SNCF, he said that these attacks on railway tracks were premeditated, calculated, and coordinated with a desire to seriously harm Eurostar. They've been encouraging passengers to postpone trips. They've warned that all high-speed rail going to and from Paris has been diverted. This comes in a week where Europe's relationship with Islam is on display. Now, I should say we don't know for sure who's behind these attacks, and we don't know for sure if this is a radical Islam attack. They've not said. But another story, it's certainly a very high possibility. And one story as well that's highlighted this week is from Germany, where Germany has been coming through and raiding some key Islamic centers. Hamburg's oldest mosque, this iconic blue mosque, has been raided. And for a long time, Germany has kind of, they've forged these quite close links with groups like the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps during the Yugoslav War, where both of them wanted to break up Yugoslavia. And they kind of took this approach with a lot of radical Islamic groups, like, well, if you leave us alone, we'll leave you alone. You can set up on German soil as long as you don't actually plan any attacks in Germany. It's all good. That's been breaking down in recent years. And I think we saw that quite vibrantly on display with what was going on in the news earlier this week with that raid on the Blue Mosque. There were 53 other properties raided across Germany. The Financial Times called it one of the most significant crackdowns on political Islamism in the country in years. The Interior Ministry said they were doing this because of totalitarian rule, aggressive anti-Semitism, and support for the terrorist group Hezbollah. So all of that is going on in Germany. So there's some European-wide problems that I think could well be exposed going on in France. The Israeli Foreign Ministry warned that with the French Olympics that Iran would be planning some kind of attack against the Israeli delegation. So we could see some European-wide problems exposed with these Olympic Games. But I think also it shines a harsh spotlight on the social problems in France, the general dissatisfaction with the government, and now you've got groups potentially trying to sabotage the Olympics and the opening ceremony. So watch that. We'll be going into the opening ceremony this evening. I guess that will be beginning right around the same time as this show. I'm sure we'll have an update on how the Olympic Games are going and what that spotlight exposes. I've just been working on a Trumpet print article about how the social political divisions within France could well give Germany an opportunity to all the more decisively dominate Europe. That's another critical prophecy that we're looking at. The rise of Germany, just like so much of our Middle Eastern coverage revolves around the rise of the King of the North and ultimately about then their ambitions on Israel. We're watching for Germany to lead Europe and the rise of a religious power in Europe that also has its sights in Jerusalem. So keep watching that. Thank you very much for joining us today. If I can just recommend one piece of material kind of relating to all of these different subjects that we've covered, I would really encourage you to go on our website, thetrumpet.com, get that booklet, The Eternal Has Chosen Jerusalem. It is so fantastic for orientating your world news watching, helping you understand what's going on in the Middle East, but just most importantly, showing you that behind so much of this bad news, there is just incredible hope, and that God has a plan just to revive the whole world and to bring so much wonderful truth into the whole world, and that all revolves around Jerusalem. So if you go to our website, thetrumpet.com, you click on the literature tab, you can go and get that book, The Eternal Has Chosen Jerusalem. Well, like I said, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for three guests today. Thank you very much for production to Isaac Lorenz and George Haddad and engineering and all the other work that you've done. And we'll hopefully see all of you right back same time next week. And until then, keep watching your world.